is Rajiv and Luca. And before I start going into details, let me explain why do we need another, well, why I think we need another talk about conformal blocks. So yesterday, Walter and David told us a very nice story about how we now have unlimited, infinite computational resources and that we should come up with new complicated bootstrap problems and throw SDPB and millions of CPU hours at them. And one way of coming up with such problems, I mean, it's not like it's the goal, but one way of having complicated problems is taking a bunch of your favorite scalar operators, considering large mixed correlators. Another way is to consider correlation functions with spinning operators. For example, you can take your favorite set of scalar operators and, let's say, throw in the stress tensor and ask, well, how this improves your balance now that you have provided extra information that your theory has a stress tensor. And I don't want to spend a lot of time motivating why we should study correlation functions spinning operators. But the point is that it's a bit hard to set up these problems, and I think the problems to spinning operators, and I think the hardest part is actually computing the conformal blocks. And so, similar to how we have, like, you know, we gradually are automating various things, like we have a nice SDPB, we have nice code for scalar blocks. Similarly, we would like to have a nice code for spinning blocks so that we can run larger problems and better constrain our theories. And to explain why I think there is more work to be done on this front of scalar conformal blocks, let me maybe briefly review the state of the art with conformal blocks. So to set some background, let me start with scalar blocks. So scalar blocks are some functions, which I'll call G, which depend on scaling dimension of intermediate operators, P and J, and they are functions of two cross ratios, Z and Z bar. In principle, they also depend on external scaling dimensions through delta 1, 2 equals delta 1 minus delta 2, and on delta 4, 3. But in what follows, I'll ignore these labels. And now, for these blocks, we have several methods of computing them. So for example, in even dimensions, there exist analytic expressions. In terms of 2F1s. In all dimensions, in general, the best we can do is to write some series expansions. And there are two main types of series expansions. And these types depend on which variable you expand in. So one type is expanding in variable S, which is just the square root of Z bar. And the other expanding in terms of variable R, which is square root of rho bar, where rho is a standard radial variable defined as z over 1 plus square root of 1 minus z squared. And as was explained by Slava and Matthias, this variable is much nicer. For example, at crossing symmetric point, r is 0.17. So it's nice to expand on this number. But also, the more important feature is that if you actually expand conformal blocks in powers of R, the coefficients do not grow that much. Whereas if you expand them in powers of S, the coefficients of the power series expansion are growing faster, and the expansion in practice converges much, much slower for numerical purposes. So we can get the series expansions also from two different methods, mostly. One based on Casimir equation, Casimir differential equation, and from Rezidue recursion relation, something that I'll call the Rezidue recursion relation. This is something that Zamolodchikov derived first for Virasoro conformal blocks, and then it was extended to global blocks in higher dimensions by David and Philip, and then other people like Joao, Emilia, and Sahida studied it for spinning blocks as well. So these two methods, they produce series expansions nicely. It turns out that the Casimir method is best suited for producing expansion in variable S. The residue recursion relation better suited for producing the recursion relations in variable R, and the series expansions in variable R. And for numerical purposes, we want to have R series expansion, so that's a good reason to use residue recursion relations. And it also turns out that the residue recursion relations, just by their structure, the form in which they provide answer is perfect for use with SDPB, so it's like a really great tool, and we love it. So for numerical purposes, I think everybody uses these recursion relations, and they're known very explicitly for scalar blocks, and there exist efficient implementations. For example, as Walter mentioned yesterday, there is this C++ implementation called scalar blocks, which has, I think, which you can download and run on your laptop, and it's great. Now for spinning blocks, so if you go to spinning blocks, now these functions get some extra indices, which I'll explain in a second. And we also have, you know, analytic expressions in even dimensions. And we also have series expansions. However, additionally, we have another method, which is which works in all dimensions. I'll write it here. And this method is, can be schematically summarized that we express a spinning block. As some differential operator acting on a scalar block. Well, in practice, you have some sequence of scalar blocks, but the statement is that any spin-conformal block can be written as a particular differential operator acting on some finite set of scalar blocks. So we have this three methods. And for numerics, the most practical, it turns out to be the residue recursion relations and this differential operator method. So the analytic expressions just turn out to be too complicated. Series expansions, you can relatively easily find the series expansion variable S using Casimir differential equation, but it's hard to go to variable R. So it's really we are stuck with among existing methods with residue recursion relations or with this differential operator. However, the problem with these two methods, it's not so much of a problem. We can compute any block and we have successfully ran numerical bootstrap setups using these methods. But sort of the annoying problem is that for each of these methods, like as soon as you get a new type of a conformal block, you have to go sit down, do some algebra. Say, for example, you have to derive this differential operator for your particular spinning block. And if you want to use residue recursion relations, they depend on some coefficients, which you have to sit down and derive. You have to do this every time you encounter a new spinning block. So this is kind of annoying, and it prevents us from just writing a code like spinning underscore blocks, which you can say, like, compute for me, like, you know, two stress tensors, one current, one scalar block, with these parameters, hit enter, and just go and take a break. So there is no such program, and my point is that the reason for this is that while these methods allow us to compute any block, they involve some intermediate steps which require like figuring out some formula. Like we don't have closed form expressions for all these blocks. And so the goal of our work was to fix this problem in the residue recursion relations. The point of our paper and what we succeeded in doing is deriving some closed form expressions for all intermediate steps for this recursion relation, so that now we can hope to actually write such a magical problem. So I'll now go into details of all this stuff, but are there any questions about motivations? Or maybe somebody wants to complain with my assessment from blocks. Okay. So first, let me define what these spinning conformal blocks are. So to start, we consider some four-point function, some four operators, four primary operators, so 1 through 4. And in general, we consider them, we allow them to have arbitrary spins. So in principle, they have some spin indices, but I'm not going to write them out explicitly. You should just, as when you see L1 on the left-hand side and you see L1 on the right-hand side, you should imagine it has some index which is the same on both sides. So using conformal invariants, we can expand this four-point function in the basis of four-point tensor structures, which we'll denote in the same way as the four-point function, but with an extra index I, which labels the four-point tensor structures, and this index I, it runs over some finite set. And they're multiplied by some functions, j of cross ratios. What we are interested in is the contribution of some primary operator O to the LP of O1 and O2. So from now on, I will focus on three dimensions. I should say that whatever everything I'm going to be saying can be generalized to higher dimensions, modulo some problems, and even the but just for simplicity and as the first most practical case, I will focus on 3D. So in three dimensions, I can assume that all my operators are Hermitian in order to not distinguish O and O dagger. So that's what I'll do. And the contribution of this operator to the OP will depend on 2 3-point functions, O1, O2, O, which can also be expanded in tensor structures. Some lambda left A and O4, O3, O, which I also expand. And finally, to define the conformal block, I should also choose some normalization for the 2-point function of O. So for the 2-point function, I choose some conventional expression, just set some convention. So I need to fix this in order to fix the normalization of conformal block. So after I have provided the basis of 4-point tensor structures, the basis of 3-point tensor structures, and some convention for the 2-point function, I can define this object as saying that this function over here, gi, the contribution of O and its descendant to it is given by ZZ bar. It contains term, which looks like somewhere A and B, lambda left A, lambda right B, GAB, delta JI of ZZ bar, where delta and j are the scalar dimension and spin of O. That's how we define the conformal block. And in the case of scalar conformal blocks, people often just say, OK, conformal block is some function which is like satisfies Casimir. Differential equation has this leading term. They specify normalization of the conformal block by specifying the normalization of the leading term. When you work with spinning blocks, like even writing down the leading terms is a mess. So the really only meaningful way of specifying your normalization for your conformal block is to specify 4-point structures, 3-point structures, and the 2-point function. So please, if you write papers about spinning conformal blocks, do this, because otherwise I cannot understand. OK. So now, how can we compute this conformal block by definition? So by definition, as I said, we want to take OP of O1 and O2. The way we usually write OP is write O1 of X1, O2 of X2 is sum over different primaries O. Then there's this B coefficient. Then there are some differential operators. Depend on X1. X2 and ddx2. And we have O at x2. So these differential operators are conformally invariant and they're fixed by conformal symmetry. And there are just several of them. So these are like OP structures. The way in which you can fix this differential operators is by using this OP in, say, in three-point function. So then we get the condition that 1 of x1, 2 of x2, O of x, the tensor structure is equal to t1 to O, same index, 1 x2, acting on the two-point function. So you can treat this equation as the equation which determines this differential operator. And now if you have this differential operator, then we can use this OP inside the four-point function, and we get the formula that all phi is the OP. What we find is fc1 to O, a x1, x2, dt, x2. And so this is the contribution to the full four-point function. And by definition here, find that this is equal to sum over I 1 or I GAB delta J I. Okay, are there any questions about how I define the conformal blocks? Okay. So now the statement is that the whole idea of this residue recursion relations is that the conformal blocks have poles as functions of delta, and the residue of these poles are proportional to other conformal blocks. And while with scalar blocks, the meaning of proportionality is clear, with spinning blocks, it's a bit more tricky because spinning blocks have some indices, and it's not like you have a single spinning block. And so in general, you get some matrices. So let me quickly derive this residue relation from this kind of definition. And for that, I'm going to pull out one fact from nowhere, which we'll obtain in a different way in like maybe 10 minutes or something. But first, let me just take it as an assumption. So the assumption is that if I take this differential operator, c1 to O, a of x1, x2, d, dx2, as we change the scalar dimension on delta, sometimes, so this operator, it depends not on operator O specifically, it depends on its quantum numbers, delta and j. So we can change the scalar dimension of delta, and we can ask how this operator behaves. And the claim that I'm just taking for granted for now is that it occasionally has poles, some scalar dimensions delta equal delta star, where the residue is takes this form. There is some matrix L A prime, which multiplies some C A prime of 1, 2 with some new operator L prime, x1, x2, dd, x2. And additionally, on the right, there is some new differential operator d, which depends only on dd, x2. And this differential operator is conformally invariant when delta equals delta star, so that acting on O, it produces something which transforms like O prime. So in this equation, we reiterate here, we have standard differential, like OP differential operators for some O with scalar dimension delta and spin J. Whereas here, we have standard differential operator for some scalar dimension delta prime and J prime. And this differential operator takes operator with scalar dimension delta star and spin J to scale operator with scalar dimensions delta prime and spin J prime. So this is the sort of thing that I'm going to start with. And then we'll see the justification in a little bit. So if you use this relation in this definition of conformal block, what you find is that conformal block G delta J I A B, it has a pole delta equals delta star whose residue is given by L A prime some R B B prime G A prime B prime delta prime J prime I, where this matrix L is as here, and the matrix R is defined by the following identity. O3, O4, O3, D, O, some tensor structure. So take some standard tensor structure for O4, O3, and O, we act on this differential operator D, and we get some tensor structure for operator O prime, so we can expand it as some R, B, B prime, O4, B, O prime, with some index B prime. So, statement is that there's this assumption, conformal blocks have residues which are given in this way, with some matrices L and R. You can compute R in this way, you know, the differential operator D. And I haven't told you how to determine L, yet, but that's what I'll do now. Before I do that, are there any questions about how this comes about? Okay. So to determine L, the thing that you can do is you can take this equation and you connect with both sides of it on the two-point function. So like here. So on the left-hand side, just by this definition, instead of this differential operator, you'll get three-point tensor structure O1, O2, OA. And here, you'll get this differential operator acting on the point function DO of X, and then O. D O of x2, D O of x. Now, we don't know how this kind of operators act on objects of this form, where we have some two-point function, we have a differential operator acting on one of some differential operator acting on one of the primaries, and there is nothing in the other. If you set here delta equals delta star, then this, will, because this differential operator will become conformally invariant, this two-point function you can show it will vanish, but still it's a bit strange object for delta not equal to delta star. So get around this, we can act on this equation on O on both sides with this differential operator D again, so that we get DO here and DO here. And then we also can observe in practice, I mean, you can prove this, but this is more or less an intuitive observation, that if you take the point function DO, then as I said, if you set scale dimension of O to be delta star, this will vanish. So it has some delta minus delta star term. But then you can argue that if you look at the leading order, then it has some coefficient which I'll call Q, which is just a constant, and times the standard two-point function of O and O prime. If you use this relation here, we'll replace this by standard two-point function O prime times some coefficient Q. Delta minus delta star is going to cancel this pole. And the relation that we'll find is O1, O2, DO, A is U, times L A prime, 1, 2, L prime, A prime. So now we have written the set of equations here that you can just forget about everything else. And if you know some, if you know the differential operator D, and you have chosen some basis of three-point tensor structures and some basis of two-point functions, some standard two-point functions, you can use you can act with this differential operator D on these structures. You can find out what Q is. You can find out what the matrices L and R is, and then you know this recursion relation. So the whole trick of deriving this residue relation is to figure out what action of D on three-point function is and action of D on two-point function is. So that's what I'm going to explain now. Are there any questions about this argument? Okay. So this theory, it's a bit, I tell it in a bit different form, but this theory is, of course, well known, and it's not something new. What is new is actually how we do this calculation and how we derive this L and R together with Q. So in principle, I can just tell you what is the technology for action with these differential operators is, but it turns out that if I introduce the technology that I need to compute this L and R, I can also give a very quick derivation of the recursion relation without making this assumption that I just described. And it also gives a nice classification of, gives a very nice and easy way to classify all this poles delta star. So let me describe this first. So we are used in Euclidean CFT to use radial quantization. We put some operators at the origin, we put derivatives of the operators at the origin, and then produces some states, and this is complete in the representation generated by some primary O. In Lorentzian signature, there is a different way of producing states. So we have our whole Hilbert space of CFTs, some over some sub-representations associated to primary operators. And in radial quantization, we say that the spaces are spans of something like O at zero, where this is Euclidean zero, which is not going to be what. So this is Euclidean. Some derivatives, and so on. In Lorentzian signature, you can write a different formula of this type, or say that this is span over all test functions f of just objects of the form integral dx f alpha of x, o alpha of x. So this is the standard kind of Whiteman way of constructing states where you act with some operator in the vacuum and you smear it with some test function to make sure it's normalizable. It's not what I'm going to use, but from here you can see that you can also write the same Hilbert space by taking Fourier transform of both F and O. So the space is spanned also by states of this form. Where O alpha of P is defined as, I'm going to put it here. Just Fourier transform of the usual operator. And the state is just O of P acting in vacuum. So the reason So we can see that the states span the full representation, but they also turn out to have a very, very nice property that they are orthogonal, in a certain sense. So before I explain why they're orthogonal, let me specify what this index alpha is. So as I said, I'm going to work in three dimensions, so we can label the spin degrees of freedom of an operator by spin projection M, where M runs from minus J, J. But I also have to specify spin projection on what axis this is, and a natural and nice choice is to make the spin projection to choose P as a quantization axis. So M is going to be the projection of spin on. So this is a bit, so this means that this index is, kind of the definition of this index depends on the value of P, which is going to obscure some things, but it will make other, like the things that are relevant to us, much cleaner. So with this definition of OM, you can compute the inner products between the states. And we can almost write down the answer by just symmetries. So we take some O M prime of P prime, taking a product with O M of P. So the first thing we notice is that because of translational invariance, the momentum has to be conserved. So we have 2 pi. Momentum conserving delta function. Then by dilatation invariance, we should make sure that the scaling dimensions and all on both sides agree, and then we have to add something like some power of momentum. And because our theory has positive energies, we should also restrict P to be in future null cone, which I'll denote by this theta of P. And finally, since P has to be equal to P prime, and we can rotate around, we can ask about invariance and rotations around P or P prime. And since M and M prime are just projections on P and P prime, it follows that M prime and M have to be equal. But there must be Kronecker delta for between M and M prime. And the only thing we have not fixed is some overall coefficient, which can depend on M. So there are some coefficients, BM, depend on M, and they also depend on scale dimension spin of the operator O in general. So, yeah.
Like, do the operators still transform in the usual way under Lorentz transformations, or is there some additional dependence on spin?
Well, they transform in the usual way. It's just that for every choice of, you can think about it this way. I have operators with some index alpha, which is the usual index, so I don't know, like some spinner index or whatever. And this thing transforms in the usual way. And then to define OM, I multiply this O alpha by some transformation matrix, which is P dependent, and which transfers me from the alpha basis to the basis of eigenstates under rotations around them. Around P. So the key point here is, yeah, I mean, they're going to have some bit tricky transformation of under Lorentz group if you try to write it down. But it doesn't matter so much to us, it just matters how they transform under Lorentz transformations which rotate P. Any other questions about this formula? Okay, so there are these coefficients, BM, and they're not constrained by Lorentz scaling or translation invariance because we have taken all that into account, but we know that the two-point functions in conformal field theory are fixed uniquely. So the thing that these coefficients are constrained by are the special conformal transformations, which we have not yet considered. And under this, so in momentum space, special conformal transformations are some second-order differential operator. And if you study the second-order differential operator, act on this expression, on the ansatz, you can find that the special conformal transformations are respected if this BM satisfies the recursion relation. So this recursion relation is fairly simple, and you can solve it up to an overall normalization. And to find the overall normalization, you can just compute. You can just set, let's say, M and M prime to be J. That simplifies the position space two-point function, and you can do Fourier transform analytically. And so in the end, you can prove that EM in three dimensions is some standard normalization of two-point function takes form, roughly speaking. Well, not roughly, exactly. Like this. So it's some very explicit expression, and so it tells you what this inner product is. But the most important point is that this just tells you what is the kind of norms of each state, OM of P, but otherwise they're orthogonal to each other. And this orthogonality allows us to write a completeness relation, which says that just the projection onto the subspace H of O, PO, is given by sum over M, the inverse of M delta J, and we have a momentum integral some power of momentum and just OM of P by M. And now we can just compute conformal blocks essentially by inserting this projection operator in the middle of four-point function. And if we do this, then we get an expression for conformal block, which is as follows. So let me write it here so that I'll can reference it later. So we have this expression that we had before. Have the sum over M, D versus M of delta J. And we have an integral we have P to some power, which I'm not going to write out. Then we just have O1, O2, M of P. This is computed from the tensor structure with index A. And then we have 4 or 3 IM of P 304 computed from tensor structure is index B. And the nice thing about this representation of conformal block is that actually all the poles that we're interested in are coming from this factor B inverse of M. Because this factor tells you when some I erased it, but as I said, BM just tells you the norms of certain states in momentum space, and vanishing of this factor tells you that you have some null states, which is the usual reason for having poles in the conformal block. So you can just take this formula, and you can ask, for which values of delta and J, does it have a zero for at least one value of M? And you can classify such pairs of delta and J, and you get four families of zeros, which precisely agree with those classified by Emilio, Zhao, and Masahito. So I said four families. I can write them down. So the family 1, 2, 3, 4. So we have your delta is 1 minus J minus K. Your delta is 2 plus j minus k. And here we have 3 over 2 minus k. And finally, 2 minus k. And k here is a positive integer. And we have a restriction here for that k is less or equal to j. And in these two families, we have a restriction in one of them depending on whether we are talking about integer or half integer j. So this restriction applies to family 3 if you're talking about half integer j, and to family 4 if you're talking about integer j. So if you know, if you're familiar with recursion relations, say for scalar blocks or for scalar Fermion blocks, you can notice that in those recursion relations, one of the families does not appear. And this is because the corresponding matrices in L and R happen to vanish. And we will see why this is so in a second. So it seems from this equation that it should be straightforward to compute what is the residue of a conformal block by just staring at this DM and computing its residue. But we know that the answer should somehow involve some differential operators, which we haven't yet figured out. So I'm now going to describe these differential operators, but before that, I want to ask if there are any questions about this formula. Okay, cool. So for differential operators, the idea is the same, to use this nice momentum space basis. And we can simply ask what is if it take differential operator O, sorry, D, act on some primary O, and we go to this momentum space basis, some P. How does it express, and what is the expression for this in terms of OM of P? And again, by just thinking about scale invariance, translation invariance, Lorentz invariance, we can show that this expression has to have this form.
I actually have a question about that formula on the left.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, to derive that formula, you nicely used this language of Hilbert spaces and so on. But in the end, like, if you just stare at this formula, this is, I mean, this equates to things. Like, you could say, okay, maybe I could define the blocks on the left in radial quantization. On the right, I just have some integrals. I mean, I didn't need to know about anything about Hilbert space.
No.
So can you, like, post factum understand why this formula has to be true even for someone who doesn't like have a Hilbert space picture?
Well, you can understand this, I think, by saying that, okay, this is like invert, like this formula is actually almost the same formula that you would write if you wrote the moment the shadow representation for conformal block. It's just that you would have to use, instead of these BMs, you would use the BMs that, so you get these BMs from Whiteman two-point function, but if you use the BMs that you get from time-ordered two-point function, you would just get the shadow representation. And so you can think of this, I guess, by just saying that you took the shadow representation and you cleverly subtracted the shadow piece. No, it's just integral over Lorentzian momenta. There is no choice of country. It's just the kind of Lorentzian stuff takes care of this. I mean, if you can probably reformulate this as some Euclidean integral with choice of country by deforming. Right, so for fraction differential operators, you can write the same kind of formula where you have to preserve the momentum by translation invariance. You have to preserve M by Lorentz invariance, and you have to put some power of P by dilatation invariance, and the only thing you don't know is some proportionality coefficient which depends on M. And again, you can ask for invariance under special conformal transformations. And special conformal transformations, essentially everything works the same way as you constrain the two-point function. It just here it's a bit more complicated because you have two different representations on both sides. And you end up having three constraints. first constraint that you find is that the quadratic Casimir of DO has to be the same as the quadratic Casimir of O. And then you find two recursion relations, which I'm not going to write out explicitly, but they're just a little bit more complicated than the recursion relations that we had for BMs. So there's some prefactor times DM equals some prefactor times DM minus 1. And you get actually two of them with different coefficients. And you have to make sure that these two recursion relations are compatible. And asking for their compatibility, you find that the quartic Casimir has to agree. So the compatibility of these equations is telling you that the quartic Casimir of DO is the same as quartic Casimir of O. But this is, of course, not surprising because we know that differential operators have to preserve the Casimirs. And but computation-wise, requiring that quadratic Casimirs and quartic Casimirs agree, this condition, given the choice of delta and J, give you 7 choices for delta prime and J prime. And you can further cut this down by requiring that this differential operator, when actually exists, expressed in position space, is polynomial in derivatives, which is a bit non-trivial, so you kind of appeal to previous classification. But by saying some technical words, you can say that these conditions, they restrict you to 4 families, which correspond to 4 families of differential operators, which correspond to these 4 families of poles. And for each family of for each given family, you can solve these recursion relations and find the coefficients dm. So for example, let me just give one example. For family 4, sorry, for family 3, find some expression which looks like which looks like this. And you can notice that the dependence on M only interests in this factor, and the rest is some canonical normalization, which and the choice of normalization I'll explain in a second. But before, are there any questions about deriving these coefficients DM? Or relation of these coefficients to differential operators? OK, so I wrote this operator with some particular nice normalization, and the way this normalization is determined is essentially to make this cube be equal to 1. And the way we can understand which what is the normalization of DM is by taking this equation and going to momentum space. And if you think about it a little bit, then the equation that you find from the momentum space version of this equation is simply that if you take dm squared, which are some constants, multiplied by bm of delta nj, then near poles, this looks like u times delta minus delta star times b of delta prime, bm of delta prime j prime, or delta prime and j prime, are the ones that correspond to your pole. And so what we do is we just set this q to be 1, thus fixing the normalization of the differential operator. This is just a convenience choice so that we don't have to carry this q around. But a nice way to write this condition, normalization condition, is to say that the residue of BM inverse delta J delta equals delta star is just dm squared times b inverse delta prime k prime m. And now we can see how the recursion relation follows from this formula. If you go to some pole of this function near this pole, you can replace the residue by bm for new scalar dimension delta prime j prime times square differential operator. So here you'll get delta prime j prime, and you'll get dm squared. Then you can send one of these dms to be here, and another to be here, and you recognize that these three-point functions are now just the same three-point functions as here. And in this way, by combining this relation and this normalization, as well as this definition of the differential operator, you can reproduce the recursion relation. Okay, now this is all nice, and it tells you how to derive the recursion relation, but I haven't told you how to actually compute anything here except for Q. So Q we have simply set to 1, so we don't have to worry about it now. So I can remove it, but I still need to tell you how to compute the action of differential operators on tensor structures and how to extract these matrices LA and LB. L and R. And so let me get to that part.
Actually, I'm a bit, I'm a bit confused why you're not done yet, because you already showed that there's a recursion relation, so.
No, we
but
knew
now
that
it's a recursion relation for the whole sum over blocks times, or tensor structures times blocks, and now you want to. Last step, yeah, what
okay,
is missing here?
Let me review the logic. So we knew already before our work that there is a recursion relation, and we knew these equations. What I was, like, I now, what I have just done is I rederived this recursion relation and these equations from this momentum space picture.
Yeah.
But that was not necessary. I didn't have to do that. The only reason I did this is I had to introduce these DMs and BMs anyway. So I, since I had to introduce them, I also derive this recursion relation just for fun, if you will. Now I'm going to use this technology to actually use these equations to compute these matrices. Because, we are done in the sense that we have the recursion relation, but we don't have the expression for L and R. So that's the goal, to find an expression for L and R.
But you do have the recursion, I mean, you said it's just for fun, but I have a feeling that it's more than just for fun. You seem to be downplaying the importance. You already have a recursion relation for the whole sum of conformal blocks contained convolved with tensor structures. Why is that recursion relation not good enough for our purposes?
No, it's good enough, but you still have to use, from this formula, just this same result follows, where L and R are defined by the same equations.
Okay.
So this was just rederivation of this result from kind of momentum space perspective. But it doesn't tell you how to compute this L and R. Well, I mean, it does tell you in the sense that you take the tensor structure act as differential operator and read this off, but like, we don't.
Okay.
I want to have closed form formula
okay,
for this L and R.
I think I see it. Thanks.
Okay. So, how do we do this calculation? So, we want to compute the left-hand side here and solve this equation. So one nice thing about this equation is that it's conformally invariant. So D is conformally invariant, it acts on conformally invariant three-point structure, and we expanding it back on conformally invariant three-point structure. So one consequence of this is that we can take, you can set the coordinates of operators here to whatever we want, because if we know a conformally invariant three-point structure in one configuration of points, we will know it everywhere, because we can use conformal transformations to computed. And in particular, the nice thing to do in this situation is to take O1, be placed at 0, and has some index alpha. So for now, I'm in position space for these operators. For a second, I'm back in position space for everything. So O2 at place at infinity has some index beta, and operator O, I place at some positions x some index gamma, and you have index a. And my goal is to apply a differential operator to x. Now, what is this expression? So if you reflect a little bit on this, you realize that, well, if I try to write a formula for this, what I can use? I can use x to some power, and I can use x with a bunch of open indices. And then I need to turn these indices into these indices for alpha, beta, and gamma. So what this means is that I have some tensor, just some invariant tensor that I'll call Q, which there is one for each tensor structure, which has indices alpha, beta, gamma, and the same indices mu1, mu j. So I'm contracting this space. And this power is just fixed by scaling invariance, and it's equal to x to minus delta 1, 2, minus j. And so this large j, in principle, doesn't have any relation, a priori relation to spin of O. So this is large j, spin of O is small j. This is just the most general right-hand side you can write. And observation number one is that there are finitely many different such tensors that you can write, and they are in one-to-one correspondence with tensor structures. Simply because if you have a tensor structure, you can compute a tensor in this way. You can just plug these numbers, express it, the result in this way, and you read off what the tensor is. And if you have a tensor, you can define your tensor structure to be given by this formula, and then using conformal invariance to define it for other configurations. Now, so we reduce a classification of tensor structures to classification of such tensors. The first step is to notice that any tensor you can expand in traceless symmetric components with respect to indices mu1 and mu j. So you can assume that this mu1 and mu j are traceless symmetric. And then what this tensor does, it takes three representations which have spin j1 for alpha, j2, and j for gamma, and produces some spin j, which is traceless symmetric. Oh, in three dimensions, every integer spin is traceless symmetric, so just spin j. So how we can label different ways of doing this? We can just kind of resolve this by saying that we are first going to combine j1 and j2 into some j12. And for convenience, I'll also call this, use new notation for this outgoing j as j12o. So I first combine 1 and 2 into j12, and then I fuse them into j12o. Standard angular momentum business. So I can always write this. So the tensor structure is labeled in this way. So I have this label A. It's just a pair of j12 and j12o. And this tensor Q is defined by just the product of two Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. So I have classified the tensor structures in some particular way. But this way turns out to be very nice for our purpose, because now we want to take Fourier, we want to use this formula for differential operator that I erased. And for that, we want to go to Fourier space. And the statement is that it's very easy to take Fourier transform of this expression. The reason for that is since this is traceless symmetric, we can, here for the product of x's, we can write x's minus traces. And then we have a formula right here that if you have integral dx, eipx, x to some power, x mu1, mu j, so this minus delta minus j, minus traces. The only thing I can write as the answer by Lorentz symmetry is E mu 1 mu j minus traces times some power of p, which is fixed by dilatation invariance, and times some coefficient, which I'll call f delta j. So if I decide to compute Fourier transform of this three-point function, what I'll get is something very similar in momentum space times coefficient delta plus delta 1, 2, j 1, 2, o, which is the same as j. So this tells me that it's easier for me to compute the Fourier space expressions for such three-point functions. And then the only thing that I have to do in Fourier space is to apply this differential operator D. Now in Fourier space, I will have here E some power different here. And the tensor U is going to have indices mu1, mu j contracted with p. And if I think about this in terms of these components, it's like saying that for this representation, I set spin projection to be zero because I'm just computing the component along p. And since the spin projection is zero, the spin projections of these three guys have to add up to zero as well. Now, spin projection of O1 plus spin projection of O2 cannot exceed this J12 because I have combined them in this J12 representation. And this means that the spin projection of gamma cannot onto P also cannot exceed an absolute value, this J12. But J12 is something finite. Like if you take scalar for point function, J12 has to be zero. If you take stress tensor for point function, J12 will be like up to five. So it means that I only need to use this coefficients dm up to m equals five, for example, to compute the action differential operator stress tensors. And so to actually sort of act with dm, you have to do a little bit of just a little bit of group theory with Clebsch-Gordan coefficients to pull out this m component, multiply it, combine it back into this kind of expression. And let me just write the answer. I'm not going to explain it in the derivation in great detail, but it's kind of intuitive, so I hope it's going to be clear. So from this kind of logic, in this basis of three-point tensor structures, we get the following expression. So the indices are now J12, J12O. So remember, this L has two indices, one index in the old space, one index in the new space. But it turns out that since we've used J1, like O1 and O2 together into J12, and actually nothing touches J12 in the whole calculation, this matrix turns out to be diagonal in this label J12. It only depends on normally change this label J12 to O. And so what this ends up being is you have two coefficients. So one is this F delta, this delta 1, 2, J12 to O, which corresponds to going to Fourier space. Then there is another one, which corresponds to going back from Fourier space after applying differential operator. And uses delta prime instead of delta and J12 to O prime. And it's to the minus first because we're going back. And the rest is just times the sum over M. And we have Clebsch-Gordan coefficients zero, J12 minus M. J prime M D M M. M. So the interpretation of this formula is fairly straightforward. What do you do? Well, I erase the tensor, but as I said, because the tensor Q was contracted with P we were taking, and it has spin J1 to O. It corresponded to like spin zero projection of representation J1 to
Peter?
O.
Sorry.
Yeah.
You dropped a prime.
Sorry?
You dropped a prime on one of the J1 to O's.
Great. It's this one.
Yeah.
Okay, so What this Clebsch Gordan coefficient does, it splits this tensor into two parts, one corresponding to operator O and one corresponding to operators 1 and 2. And it pulls out this M, then you multiply it by this DM, and then you package this back into a tensor with new spin and again projection 0. And you're just summing over M, but the sum over M, it's bounded by this J12 because M appears in Clebsch Gordan. So in any given 4-point function, this is the sum of a few terms, like 5 or 10, but this, the range of the sum does not depend on the intermediate spin. And so you can do exactly the same computation for the left 3-point function, and you get exactly the same expression, and just replace 1 and 2 by 4 and 3, and like add some sign. And that finishes the derivation of this matrices L and R. Something that I didn't have time to explain is also that you need to compute the large delta asymptotic of this function, and we can also do in closed form. But it's like an unrelated technique. It just amounts to finding a nice basis of 4-point tensor structure so that the Casimir equation to the first two orders can be solved, just becomes diagonal and can be solved structure by structure. So that's all I have to say. Let me just finish by saying that I hope that we can now use these formulas to man up and write a code for general 3D blocks and keep Walter busy with improving his DPB. Yes. All right, thank you.
Well, that was a pretty amazing simplification of the whole business. Any questions?
Yeah, how do we see that series?
Let me try. This has not been done yet.
Oh my God.
Yes, how do we see one of the residue sequences dropping out when j
right,
equals 0?
Right, great question. Thank you. What happens is that for one of the sequences, for example, if you take, say, j to be integer, and you take family 4, and you look what these DMs are, you find that, let me make a picture. So you plot M, so there is like minus j, plus j, and if you plot DMs, you find that some of there are a few non-zeros, but then in the middle, they all vanish, and then they go up again. So like DMs with small m's vanish for the family. And so if you have J12, which is too small, this sum is going to be restricted inside this window, and you'll never get a non-zero residue. There is a selection rule that you can derive from this, and essentially, like, you have, like, for example, yeah, like, there is a selection rule which tells you how many members of this forest family appear based on the spins of external operators. And the idea is based on the fact that these DMs vanish for small values of M, for one of the families.